Indeed, with our special guest tonight, Gilbert Erickson, The Millennium Prophecy. 2 hours of Gilbert next on Coast to Coast AM. Gilbert Erickson, he's a former Vietnam helicopter pilot. He has a lifelong interest in figuring out how the world works. He graduated from Cal State in Fullerton with a degree in psychology, did graduate work in descriptive linguistics at the University of Oklahoma in Norman. After studying prophecy, literature, and the Book of Revelation, Gil began to unravel some keys to uncover unity energy systems, free energy, anti-gravity systems, and then finally, the implications of Planet X. And here he is on Coast to Coast. Gilbert, how are you?
Good evening, George. How are you doing?
Good to have you with us. Fine. You know, I'm beginning to wonder about this Planet X. Years ago, I would have said, hey, this was all nonsense. I'm not sure anymore. I think there's something out there.
Mm-hmm.
What has your work uncovered, Gil?
Well, we covered a lot of that last time. Basically, the way that I came at it was as a method for trying to get an accurate interpretation, lock down the meaning of the Book of Revelation. And my original thinking in trying to deal with the judgment issues was that it was probably some kind of large comets that could do this. Excuse me.
Sure.
But after you had Jason Rand on board and the information came out about, you know, some of the information came out about what Wormwood, Planet X, was really about, he was the only one that had Wormwood with an inbound and an outbound set of issues. And that was the only pattern that lined up with the chapter 8 and the chapter 16 structure of the Book of Revelation, and that, you know, that sort of clicked for me at that time. So I got in touch with Jason Rand after the show, and we've been kind of collaborating a little bit. And then this past spring, I tried to kind of continue a little bit of that interpretive effort to figure out how the science might work. That's still a work in progress, and as you probably know, I took a guess that, you know, maybe we would get hit with another set of earthquake events and all this other stuff, mm-hmm. the sixth seal events that are described in Revelation 6. And, you know, I was a little bit nervous, but I figured it was time to call Coast to Coast and try to get the word out that this was a very real possibility.
Here we are. See, and what to me is getting upsetting is that other people looking at prophecy are coming up with some similar conclusions that something indeed is starting to happen now. And it all seems to be coming in at one time. That's kind of scary to me, Gilbert.
Well, as I covered with you in the last show, George, prophecy in the Bible is a different kind of animal than just prediction, omen, estimation, guesstimation, what have you. Prophecy is just a completely different kind of thing. A prophecy is basically information that comes from God, himself, and it's guaranteed that it'll happen. So the requirement in the Bible, in Old and New Testament, particularly in the Old Testament, is that if it's a genuine prophecy, it actually has to come to pass, and that's covered in the Book of Deuteronomy and some of the other quotations. So the point is that if it's a prophecy, there's a 100% fulfillment requirement. It must happen. Okay, the Revelation is a prophecy, chapter 1, chapter 22. It starts out and it claims, you know, that it's a prophecy, and it bookends itself in chapter 22. Again, it uses the term prophecy. So from start to finish, the Revelation is very clear that it is a prophecy, which means there's a 100% fulfillment requirement. That's the standard that God sets
mm-hmm.
for any kind of information that runs under the flag of the term prophecy.
Gilbert, this Planet X, which could be a dwarf star, could be a planet. Zechariah Sitchin says it's in a 3,600-year elliptical orbit.
Mm-hmm.
Why aren't we looking at this thing now? Why can't we see this now?
For those of you who can get up on the internet, if you come up on my website, millenniumprophecy.com. Two L's, two N's. One word, lowercase, millenniumprophecy.com. And you go to the image gallery that I have there. What you will see is a blue trace line.
Okay.
That my son did as a CG. And this shows us the problem of the orbit of Wormwood, the brown dwarf star. Now, we're still trying to kind of sort our way through the noise of what constitutes the proper science for this kind of thing. You've had, you've had Wallace Thornhill on, have you not?
Yes, yep, sure have.
And Talbot. Have you had Don Scott on?
I don't recall.
Okay, Wallace
Art might have had him, but I don't think I did.
Okay, Wallace Thornhill and Don Scott are very closely tied together in that Thunderbolts project.
Okay.
Now, the case that they're trying to make is that the real world of astronomy is driven much more by the plasma physics than it is by just gravitation-only kinds of rules. And the case is really very compelling. It's a pretty massive paradigm shift. So how they would talk in terms of the genesis of a brown dwarf star like Wormwood or Bitterness is that it is actually literally a chip, an explosion chip off the old block, which would be the sun. Okay?
All right.
As the plasma charge from the galaxy transfers to the swirling disk of the sun, and that swirling disk slowly congeals with your heavier elements toward the center, and then your an array of elements going all the way out, you know, lighter stuff farther out, that kind of thing. What you get is this tremendous spread of, you know, leftover supernova star debris. And that swirling disk then will aggregate the most amount of mass in the center. At a certain point, the swirling disk is going to attract tremendous amounts of plasma charge energy from the homopolar motor of the galaxy itself. And if you really want the tech explanation, then you really should talk to, you know, Dr. Don Scott and to Wallace Thornhill. Those are people who really know that stuff. That's their area. But what it does then, it means that Wormwood is actually the binary little sister, or, you know, the off-cast orphan or something. But it's literally a chip off the old block during the formation of our solar system. At a certain point, then, this massive charge produces this Z-pinch thing, which blows it sort of out the bottom, if you would. And that's where you get this long 3,671 years or something like that, this long, long elliptical orbit. It's over 1,800 years outbound and 1,800 years inbound. So anyway, have the people go up on Millennium Prophecy and go to the gallery page, and right there at the top, it shows the Wormwood orbital pattern. And it's this big, long, long ellipse. And that is actually, from the best that we can tell, that would be how you would best explain that kind of science, that it's literally a piece of what used to be the sun. So it's the same stuff that the sun is made out of. You've also had Jim McCanney on the program.
Sure. Many times.
Okay. Jim makes the case, was one of the early ones, a proponent of this notion of the sun as a solid mass, a core that's a solid mass. And it's not just a gas all the way down. That that really doesn't fly. And, of course, you know, the astronomy community really doesn't like that idea because it doesn't let them fudge the fudge factors that they want. It changes the rules. However, Jim McCanney's view does line up with what Wallace Thornhill and Dr. Don Scott have to say about how plasma solar systems operate. So that's kind of the genesis of where that comes from. And Wormwood really is literally a miniature star, kind of like made out of the same stuff at the core that our sun is made out of. And then it has this long, huge, long trip that it makes.
How close does it have to get, Gilbert, before it creates any kind of catastrophe here? How close does it have to get?
Well, I'm kind of like feeling along, you know, sort of in the dark on some of this in an attempt to try to impose a little bit of preliminary or preemptive order, if you would, on what's happening. My take on it was that it was affecting our weather and has been, you know, it's been perturbing the planets. So we discussed that on the last show. It's been perturbing the planets since 1821. Let's see, Alexis Bouvard, the French astronomer, noticed when he was checking the position of Uranus that it had a deflection in its orbit. When he was looking over on the summer solstice side, you know, northern hemisphere, a June solstice, let's call it that. In the June solstice, as Uranus would approach that side of the solar system, the Earth's June solstice extended out toward that direction, he noticed that there was a dip. There was a disposition, a perturbation in what should have been a near-perfect orbit. Now, Uranus was known to have pretty close to a perfect circle for its orbit. So the telescopes of the day were accurate down to one-tenth of 1 degree, which is not bad for 1821. So what he noticed, however, was that the deflection in the orbit of Uranus, that Uranus was out of place by a factor of 1 degree as measured from planet Earth. Now, Earth is way in close toward the center of the, you know, the center of the solar system, and Uranus is way out there. So a 1 degree deflection is a big deal. In other words, it not only was in the wrong place, it was in the wrong place by a measurable amount that was easy to see. They could see it and measure it. And they knew it wasn't supposed to be there. It was in the wrong spot. So he commented on that, and they've been tracking that for many years ever since. That deflection then led them to believe, well, maybe there's another planet or something out there. Something's wrong. And, of course, eventually that led to the discovery of Neptune. But the problem was Neptune had the same problem. When it got out on the extended line of Earth's June solstice, take that line and just stretch it out and, you know, cut the solar system in half and on the ecliptic plane, well, Neptune had the same issue. And that's what led to this drive to try to find the next planet that's out there that could cause Neptune to also have grief, okay? Mm-hmm. That search complements a Percival Lowell. I think it was Percival Lowell who popularized the term Planet X. Then Zachariah Sitchin and so forth picked up on it, Eric von Däniken and so forth. But Percival Lowell financed the development of the Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff. And then it was Clyde Tombaugh, who was a young man from Kansas, I think, who figured out how to do differential photography with the Lowell telescope. And he discovered Pluto. Yay, okay, now we've got an answer, sort of. Then they found out that Pluto had an orbiting satellite going around it. And it became manifestly apparent the problem with Pluto was that it was basically just a big ice cube, and it was less than the size of our own moon, and it had about 20% of the mass of our moon. So Pluto, to be honest, wasn't heavy enough to perturb a fly speck, much less a gas giant planet. So the search went on, and then it just sort of, you know, nothing was said until they tasked the Pioneer 10 and Pioneer 11 satellites to look on the southern side, south side of the ecliptic plane to see if they could find something looking in that general, you know, direction. Now, remember, we announced that this was along Wright Ascension 18. So I think that's where they were looking, and they found something.
Something's out there, but they're not sure, right?
Well, keep in mind, George, the problem was that we still didn't really understand the concept of a brown dwarf star. That's a kind of a recent sort of thing, since the 80s or 90s. That's a very recent kind of thing in astronomy. Also, you have to remember that for the bulk of, you know, astronomy's formative years, since the days of Galileo, they've only been using optical telescopes, okay? Little more than glorified binoculars, if you would. with only one binocle. Mm-hmm. But basically just, you know, glorified binoculars. When the Dobson type rigs with the reflective mirrors and all that came in instead of Cassegrain and so forth, then, you know, it got a little bit more sophisticated. It's the same thing, optical. But it wasn't until they started looking, as the Pioneer satellites did, in the infrared part of the spectrum, that the brown dwarf stars in the stellar neighborhood began to show up. And the problem was that there were so many of them. If they looked out and they had good resolution infrared equipment, it turned out that 80%, you know, by the time it was all said and done, about 80% of the stars in our neighborhood of space are binary. And they have these things, little sisters, if you would, that are associated with them. And but they can only be seen with infrared equipment. So if you switch to optical, you can't see them. But as soon as you turn the infrared on, you know, well, there they are. So they're broadcasting, but they're only broadcasting, you know, in the infrared portion of the spectrum. So, yeah, and Ed Grimsley's glasses, they came many, many years later. So, yeah, we can't all whip those out. But, boy, that would be handy, you know, if they weren't so expensive. So the discovery was just fairly recent. In other words, Percival Lowell, even if he had located the telescope in Chile or Argentina or Australia or New Zealand or something, he still wouldn't have been able to see Wormwood because he had to be looking at it with infrared eyes. The human eye can't see infrared, okay? But as soon as you start scanning that sector of space with infrared, there it is. So anyway, that's the point, is that until it gets up close in and starts reflecting the light of the sun, you're not going to be able to see it. Eventually, it'll get here. Eventually, you know, it'll start to show up, and, you know, it'll be borrowing the light from the sun so you can see it. And then it'll have that rusty red iron oxide color.
Well, you know, what does this then have to do with Mayan prophecy, Gilbert? What did they know, in your opinion?
Well, again, we don't know for sure what they knew. You know, modern-day Mayan chieftains will tell you that they knew nothing like that, that all they were doing is just trying to chart the heavens, and that they had noticed that there was the 26,500 or some odd year cycle that corresponded to the way the Earth would be situated relative to the Milky Way. So, you know, that case can be made. The fact that it has this rather odd coincidence of ending December 21st, which is, you know, December's 21st, that's the solstice day for 2012 is rather coincidental, I think. And, of course, you don't believe in coincidence.
That's right.
But, you know, did they actually know? Were they told? You know, who knows for sure? You know, the case can be made a lot of different directions. But the point is that there is this odd coincidental stuff. For my money, George, I would bet on the infrared telescope equipment.
Yes.
And now all of the major installations worldwide, they all use enhanced spectrum equipment for their scopes. And all of them are doing that. If they've got the money to buy the basic telescope, then they add the extra goodies while they're at it. There's no point not doing it because they know that there's extra stuff that they can see if they just have this enhanced stuff. They have also added not only infrared, but now they're moving to the opposite end, very, very short spectrum stuff, especially for looking at things like the sun. If you want to see past the, you know, all the yellow atmosphere of the sun and look down, you know, toward the ball underneath the iron ball, then you need to look in the ultraviolet part of the spectrum. And at that point, you can see, my goodness, there's a sphere underneath there, and you can see it. And there's pictures of that on the net, really nice. And you can see the iron ball of the sun. So enhanced spectral viewing really is kind of a, you know, Johnny-come-lately, but very handy tool in the astronomer's art, you know, very important things.
Gilbert, stay with us. We're going to take phone calls with you next. When we come right back on Coast to Coast AM, Gilbert Erickson, our guest, the Millennium Prophecy this hour on Coast to Coast. With our special guest this hour, Gilbert Erickson, we're going to take phone calls as we talk about his work, The Millennium Prophecy. Next hour, who's behind the secret door as we get near the holiday season? I do not know, but it's someone. Hey, time to give out 5 books, by the way. Don't want to throw them away. Tom's got them back in my Los Angeles office. If you fast blast him with this answer, okay, the first person who does. Now, with fast blast, we've got a timer on it, so we know exactly who sent what in at what time. So the first person to get this correctly will get 5 books. Put your email on your fast blast so Tom can get back to you and you can give him your address, okay? But if you go to NighthawkZone.com, that's one of our chat rooms, NighthawkZone.com, it's not ours, but our folks, our people, and look under Live Zone, you click that. Look for the avatar of Bad Boy. The first person who knows who that is, that avatar, it's a picture of somebody. Just send that to Tom, and if you win, he'll email you back, and we'll send you 5 great books of Coast to Coast guests, maybe even Gilbert's The Millennium Prophecy. And we'll take calls with him next on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Gilbert, as far as your book, The Millennium Prophecy, where can we get it?
What you do is you just come up on the website, millenniumprophecy.com, and there's an order page there. People can get it right off the website.
Perfect.
Still in PDF format, so it's easy to download. They can get it instantly.
Excellent. Let's take some calls. You ready?
Sure.
First-time caller, Jeff in Lancaster, California. You're up with us. Go ahead, Jeffrey.
Hey, how you guys doing? Thanks for having me on. As Gilbert, I was wondering, how do we know that there is a planet X? What evidence do we have?
Okay. keep in mind that I come from this. My entry into this public arena, if you would, is via the Revelation. The Revelation refers to something. Which is, in some translations, it's called bitterness, and in other translations like the King James and New American Standard and so forth, is referred to as wormwood, which is a bitter herb, very foul tasting. Okay. In terms of what was known and when it was known, I go into that in the book, but basically it breaks down this way. The problem was that in 1821, the planet Uranus, out on the extended line of Earth's June solstice, had a deflection in its orbit. Since it had a nearly perfectly circular orbit, it was easy to spot if you had a decent telescope. The equipment of the day was good to 1/10 of 1 degree, but there was a full degree of deflection, so it was 10 times the measurable error. That led to the discovery of Neptune. Problem was, Neptune had the same problem. That led to the discovery of Pluto, but Pluto wasn't heavy enough to perturb anything, much less a gas giant planet, because it has like 20% of the mass of our moon. Then in 1982, the Pioneer 10 and the Pioneer 11 satellites, which had been launched quite some time before, were tasked to check in the direction of this bright ascension 18, south side of the ecliptic plane. And they must have found something, because within less than a year, NASA was putting together the IRAS satellite, I-R-A-S. And you can Google this stuff. It's all on the Internet. The IRAS satellite must have found something. And that was a good rig. And after a year, NASA said, well, the IRAS satellite has run out of a helium gas to chill the bolometer. Problem was, it had an onboard cryostat for pumping it back down and turning it back into liquid, and it had a big solar array on it. So many years later, one of the people who was involved in the program said that it was still operational 5 years after NASA said it had been shut down. So that was a lie. So already you had NASA knowing something and covering something up, going to great lengths to kind of squash the information. Then they had the government programs definitely, digging in and trying to get a lot of tunneling going on. And during the 80s, we also had the the mathematical review of the physical deflection issues by Dr. Robert Sutton Harrington. Dr. Harrington was associated with Tom Van Flandern, who's been kind of a favorite with Coast to Coast. George knows about Tom.
The late Tom.
Yeah, Tom Van Flandern died this year, didn't he? I think it was this year, wasn't it?
He did earlier.
Yeah, very recently, in February, I think, this year. Anyway, Robert Sutton Harrington had a PhD in astrophysics, and using the computers of the day, he was able to determine that the odds were at least 5-1 with all the simulations he ran, something like 300,000 of them. The odds were 5-1 that whatever it was on the southern side of the ecliptic plane, and he figured it was somewhere in the neighborhood of right ascension 14, 15, 16, somewhere down there. So that puts us very close to right ascension 18, okay? And the math backed him up at the rate of 5-1 odds. And then you have the last piece of the physical evidence would be the development and the deployment, most recently, of the South Pole Telescope, which is a very large Gaussian rig, extremely expensive, very high-tech equipment, again, helium bolometers, chilling down to 1/4 of 1 degree Kelvin. There is nothing in the infrared spectrum that that rig cannot see, and it's located just not that far away from the actual South Pole, up on top of the 11,000-foot ice sheet. So we've had the finest eyes, infrared eyes, that money can buy, tracking Wormwood's inbound movement since 1982. Well, let's fudge that. 1983, we've kept a real good eye on it. So deflection since 1821, active tracking since 1983. I'm not sure what else you need in terms of confirmation. It would be really nice, you know, if we could get any of these people to let go of some pics. But officially, they don't want to do that.
Okay, next up, we go to Long Island, New York. Arlene, it's your turn.
Oh, hey, good morning, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call. I have been able to see something with my bare eyes, and there are some things that are being shown on newscasts, but they're incorrectly attributed or explained. What I've been able to see, just a couple weeks ago, I was riding across Long Island on the railroad, and it was a very slightly hazy day. I was able to look directly at the sun without, you know, getting hurt. And I saw right in front of the sun, it was a little bigger than the moon should have been, a, you know, white orb object directly in front of the sun. There was no, it wasn't publicized that there was an eclipse of any sort that day, and it was just there. I could see it. There was also something that was shown on a newscast, and what it was a picture of the sun again, but, you know, bright yellow sun, and next to it, kind of overlapping it, was an oval-shaped bright red haze, and the newscaster said, gee, isn't that a pretty rainbow? It's kind of unusual. Well, I had already always heard that, you know, this dark star, or whatever you want to call it, was comet-like and had a bright red trail behind it, and that's one of the indications that we're supposed to be looking for is when this red, you know, haze or trail is visible. Have you guys ever heard of the Mother Shipton prophecies?
Yes. The prophecies that Arlene is referring to is Mother Shipton was a really fine Christian gal from way back, 1038 or something, a long time back in England. And she was a very gifted seer, not real good looking, but quite a sensitive as a
not quite like Medusa though, right?
No, she was not a very pleasant looking woman. She was a very pleasant woman to be with. She was a wonderful gal, but the Lord revealed some things to her, and she wrote out some prophecies that somehow managed, you know, in poetry form, quatrain lines, similar to the kind of stuff Nostradamus used to do, but with a lot more accuracy. And Mother Shipton made some very interesting comments about the changes that were supposed to hit about this time, both before and after. Jason Rand covers that, the Mother Shipton prophecies, in his book, but they should be on the Internet as well.
Okay, thanks, Arlene. Next up, we go to Justin, Texas. Brandon, it's your turn. Hi, Brandon. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you guys doing?
Good, Brandon.
Okay, I just wanted to ask, along with all the stuff as far as the Planet X, there's something that they can see that's interfering with the orbits of Pluto and Uranus or Neptune, the way that affects the way that it moves around our solar system. They see something there that's pushing on it.
That's called the perturbations, the perturbing of the planetary orbit pattern. You are correct. That is visible. With a good enough telescope rig, you can actually measure how much deflection the planets are having to suffer when they get on the June side of Earth's orbit. To just take that June 21st line and extend that out, the solstice line, and as they start coming around in their orbits and they start approaching that line, the deflection thing starts happening. So, yeah, that's been visible for quite some time, and they can see it. Pluto's out there now, and it's being kind of dragged down a little bit out of where it should be as well. So, you know, the Wormwood is an equal opportunity perturber, if you want to look at it that way. Yeah, no, it does. It doesn't matter what's out there. If Saturn's out there, it gets deflected. If Jupiter's out there, it gets deflected. Whenever this thing comes to town, I mean, it's just so darn heavy, it's going to cause grief. And it can pull on anything. It doesn't really care what it is that it pulls on. It has very powerful, gravitational reach because it's not a planet. It's a chip off the sun itself, the block of iron of the sun's core. And I know the astronomers are probably rolling their eyes right now, but that really is what the sun is made out of. And the new plasma physics tends to confirm that, and the SOHO images tend to confirm that. And the ultraviolet images and the radar images confirm that. So what you have is a junior lightweight sun, and it's heavy. So it's going to send out gravity just like the sun does, like a planet does, and it's going to pull. Well, it's heavy, so it has more gravity, and it pulls. So it doesn't matter which planet gets out there. When it gets out on that side, this thing is going to pull down on it if it's in the neighborhood. Well, it's in the neighborhood, and it's been pulling them down.
I'm wondering, Gilbert, if Planet X is responsible for Atlantis sinking, for Noah's flood, and for all the major disasters that we've had over the centuries.
Well, this 3,671-year or 60-year, whatever it is, cycle, it may vary a little bit, but the cycle corresponds to the Exodus of the children of Israel, which will put you right around, 1,600 or so B.C., so that puts us in that neighborhood approximately. And then the time before that would put you right dead smack on the flood of Noah's era. So you start putting, lining this all up, and I said, well, geez, that's rather interesting that it happens to be hitting with that same exact periodicity or same approximate periodicity.
How about the period?
So, you're right.
When the Israelites left Egypt, the parting of the Red Sea. What do you think?
I should kind of correct something there. Mount Horeb, H-O-R-E-B, is not located. It's not Mount Sinai. It's Mount Horeb, H-O-R-E-B. That is not located in the peninsula. It's actually located in Arabia. It's on the other side.
Uh-huh.
And the New Testament confirms that. Paul said he went down there to stay and study for a while. When this parting of the sea happened, that was on the south side, just across from Arabia. So when they had made their way down through Sinai, as they got to the south side, you had this problem that there's a land bridge down there. Just in places, it's only like 6 feet deep. In other places, it can be over 1,000 feet deep. So if Wormwood had been in the vicinity and was messing with the tectonic plates, the parting of the seas could very easily have admitted, the 1.6 million Israelites to cross from Sinai over to the Arabian side. And here comes Pharaoh, a few hours or whatever, next day, and, well, I'll just go over across the same bridge, right? And Wormwood is messing with the tectonic plates, and it could very easily have been the exact mechanism by which Pharaoh's army ended up in the drink.
Yeah,
because all it would have to have done, is have the land settle. It didn't have to settle very much, 10, 20 feet or whatever. down they went. And those guys were riding around in chariots, you know, with their big heavy wheels and all that stuff. They were not going to float.
They were weighted down.
They were weighted down. And they had all their armor on. They were screwed. So they didn't have to go very deep to drown. You know, if you've got all that heavy weight on you, you're not going to swim as well. And, you know, so the Israelites could have gone across on a land bridge that just happened to be there for a while. And then Wormwood messes with the tectonic plates. Here comes Pharaoh. Hey, sorry, boys. You don't get to pass. So there could be a natural explanation, and it just happens to hit about that same period of time. So, yeah, Wormwood could very well have been involved in that. We don't know for sure, but it sure sounds like it.
Yep. Let's go to Carlos in Ontario, Canada, on the international line. Carlos, good morning.
Good morning to you guys. I'm actually a first-time caller. I've been listening to your show for the last few days, and I find it quite interesting. I went on the website that you have stated, the Millennium website, and I would just like to state that my concern is that many of your facts come from the Christian Bible. Now, the Christian Bible was put together by, obviously, like you guys know, by a gentleman by the name of Constantine during the time of Constantinople, I mean, to unify another world order in terms of gathering all these Christian believers to go in a certain direction or a line. Now, how can you take these scriptures and these prophecies, as you call them, to be, you know, accurate, since human fallacy has been, over the years, it's human error is so predictable?
Fair enough question. Go ahead, Gilbert.
You want me to address that one?
Yeah, well, okay. We've got about 2 minutes left.
Oh, okay. Actually, no, it wasn't necessarily Constantine who did it. He was just trying to quell some of the upheaval that was going on in the Arian conspiracy. There was a knockdown, drag-out fight at the time between Arius and Athanasius. Eventually, Athanasius did prevail at that meeting. It was called the Council of Nicaea. And then they also did manage to begin trying to piece together what is today the Christian Bible to try to figure out which books fit and which were in harmony with what else was in there. They had pretty well accepted the syntopic Gospels, the Gospel of John, and the most of the writing of Paul. But the question was what else should be admitted. So a lot of those things were resolved. I don't think there's ever been any real question about the authenticity of the book of Revelation, that Jesus, the materials that Jesus gave to St. John. That's never really been an issue, and it wasn't an issue then. This has been known to be something that had to be included, and it was. Some of the others, I mean, there's some books that make no sense at all, so it was real easy to throw those out. Others come very close. They're amazingly interesting books. For me, personally, the Gospel of Nicodemus I find quite intriguing. But they decided not to accept it, so, you know, it's not part of the canon scripture. There's some things that there's questions at the time, but, you know, they did a pretty good job. So in answer to the question, has it been messed with? No, that's not the issue. They were very, very careful to be as consistent and as accurate as they could be, and I think they did an excellent job.
Very good. Gilbert, thank you so much for being on the program, and fight that cold, would you?
Well, actually, the cold is gone. The only thing that's left is the tickling in the sore throat in the back. Yeah, and boy, that thing just hangs on, you know. It's a mess.
It's tough doing a radio show that way. You did well. Thanks. Gilbert Erickson. When I come back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM, it's Who's Behind the Secret Door. And by the way, Zendra Strother of Gastonia, North Carolina, wins the 5 books by going to NighthawkZone.com, checking Bad Boy's avatar. She correctly said it was Craig Horner from The Legend of the Seeker. It's a syndicated show out of New Zealand. Zendra, Tom, you'll get the books put together, and we'll get them out to you within a few weeks. We'll be back in a moment.